Sunday night at the Vancouver Institute. We're halfway through the dozen lectures for the winter season this year, and let me remind you that it's not too late, if you haven't already joined, to join the Institute. It's one of the easiest and nicest things to do. I know some of you have been reticent, perhaps there have been lineups or whatever, but tonight we're going to actually invite you to talk to the speaker at the reception we have afterwards, and then it'll be very easy for you also to stay and line up and join the Institute, or if you already joined, you can do what Professor Clark does, is join a second time or a third. And so we urge that kind of attention to the Institute, and it does help us to bring some of the speakers here from large distances, like last week's Dr. Joseph Rotblat. We have a very special treat today. Dr. Connie Eaves, who's the deputy director of our Terry Fox Laboratory, is involved in some of the most exciting medical research that we have anywhere. She's going to tell us about it today, and she's not only the director of the Terry Fox Laboratory, she's currently professor of medical genetics at UBC and a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, president of the National Cancer Institute of Canada, and she's a very active person in her field. She grew up in a tiny university town in Ontario, Kingston, where her father was a mathematics professor, and she came to UBC, I think it was about 20 years ago, that's not perhaps very felicitous to say, but she has established a wonderful career here, and she is one of our local heroes. I have great delight in asking you to give a hand to Dr. Eaves, who's going to speak about the origin of blood cells, a matter of life and death.
Thank you, Eric. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I'm just ecstatic to see how many people are interested in blood. This is a most exciting time in biomedical science. We stand on the verge of knowing all of the genes that encode a human being, and of being able to make use of new technologies to manipulate the genetic makeup and expression of single cells, of populations of cells, and even of whole organisms. Does this mean that diseases will fade away over the next decade, or even over the next few decades? Unfortunately, I don't think so. Why is that? The reason, I think, is that the biological processes that underlie many diseases are highly complex and involve changes in the orchestrated interplay of many gene products that are active in many cells over many cell generations. So it's much more complicated than understanding what particular genes are. We need to understand how they work in the context of cells and how cells work in the context of whole organisms. Nevertheless, even here, we are making rapid advances, and it is through, in part, the studies of how blood is formed that we have gained key insights into many of the basic processes that govern the life and death and the differentiation and the division of cells in general. So blood has served as a paradigm for basic understanding of cellular processes in general, but it has its own unique interest. We are very interested in learning how to transplant the entire blood-forming system from one individual to another, and as I will come to later, in fact, that is being used widely in the treatment of cancer and in the treatment of leukemia in particular. We're interested in being able to grow blood outside of the body so that we can make red cells and white cells, so that we can take your cells and grow them up should you need a transplant without needing to harvest a significant portion at the time of crisis. We're also interested in the possibility that we can genetically manipulate the most primitive elements of the blood-forming system that can be transplanted, that may be useful therapeutically, that may even serve as vehicles for expressing genes to solve problems that have nothing to do with the blood. I personally have been involved in this type of study, that is, studies that address the origin of blood formation, for over 30 years, since my age has already been given away. I'm happy to tell you that. But I would point out that throughout this time, I have been extremely fortunate in being able to work with leaders in the field. And these include not only my mentors, but also my colleagues, in fact, my husband, as well as my colleagues in the Terry Fox Laboratory, in the British Columbia Cancer Agency, in the Vancouver Hospital, and in the University of British Columbia, all here in Vancouver, in addition to a very large number of past and present trainees. In fact, many of the ideas and findings that I am about to describe to you have been shaped by the contributions of these talented and dedicated individuals. I salute them. And I would like, at the outset, for you also to appreciate and take pride in the leadership role that Canadians have played in this field that I will discuss in this talk. And I would also like, at the outset of the talk, to acknowledge the important support that we have received to undertake this work from funds raised by the Canadian Cancer Society and the Terry Fox Runs. Now then, you may well ask, why has the study of blood cells and their origin commanded such interest and been so fruitful? And I can think of no better way to address that question than by drawing your attention to a quote made by Dr. Ernest McCullough, another Canadian who, with his colleagues in Toronto, started the modern era of blood cell research through the introduction of developmental tests, and you'll understand that later, I hope, if not already, for enumerating primitive blood cell progenitors. Dr. McCullough was, for me and many others, a superb teacher as well as a scientist of great accomplishment. His ability to capture the essence of an issue comes through in this quote that I will now show you. If I can run this system.
There we are.
So here it is. Beginnings are always of interest. The origins of rivers, rumors, and dynasties excite in turn geographers, journalists, and historians. Stem cells induce similar emotions in hematologists, since these serve as the sources of the various lineages of the cells of the blood. Now, in order for you to more fully appreciate this quote, I need to turn you all into hematologists. So, in order to achieve that goal, let me attempt to do this by giving you some additional factual information about what blood cell formation involves. Each of us has approximately 5 liters of blood in our circulatory systems. And in that 5 liters is contained 100 billion white blood cells. That is 100,000 million white blood cells. And 20 trillion, that is 20 million million red blood cells, roughly. The lifespan of a white blood cell is approximately a day. So that means every day, 100 billion white blood cells in your body kick the dust, and they, of course, must be replaced by the production of another 100 billion white blood cells. The red blood cells, as I just told you, are about 200 times more numerous, but their lifespan is about 100 times longer. So if you do the arithmetic, you end up having about twice as many red blood cells die every day as white blood cells, and of course you have to replace those as well. So this all adds up to about 300 billion new blood cells being produced every day just to keep you happy and well. If we assume that the average person lives for 80 years, this means that our bodies must contain a reservoir of precursor cells with the capacity to produce at least 6,000 trillion, 6,000 million million cells. I don't know about you, but this is getting beyond my easy concept of numbers. So to give you a sense of how many cells that is, let me translate cell numbers into volumes. A trillion cells occupies a volume of about the size of a melon, something like that. 6,000 of these would occupy 6 cubic meters, roughly. So that's what we're talking about your blood-forming system being able to produce over your lifetime. On a yearly basis, we're talking about producing about the same volume or weight of cells that equals the volume of, or weight of your body. So you can see that blood cell production must involve an extensive degree of cell amplification. In addition, this process must be regulated. If cells are produced too slowly, then our physiologic needs will not be met, and the individual may die from an inability to combat infections or to control bleeding or to obtain enough oxygen. If cells are produced too quickly, then our blood vessels will become clogged up with too many cells, and we may die of a stroke or a failure of the blood cells to get around to the places they're supposed to get to combat infections and deliver oxygen. In addition, the system has to be able to accommodate changing needs. We need to have an increased rate of blood cell production when we're growing as children, as babies and then children. And then they need to know to slow down when we're adults and we're not growing anymore. But if we lose blood by one reason or another, then the system needs to accommodate that and turn up blood cell production until we have the right number of blood cells again, and then slow down again. So the question is, how does this process of blood cell production work, and how is it controlled? This takes us right back to Dr. Till and McCullough. Dr. McCullough, I mentioned to you just a moment ago, 30 years ago in 1960, where they undertook seminal experiments with their group in Toronto. What was known at that time was that there were separate precursors for red blood cells and for white blood cells. And each of those types of precursors could make about 20 daughter cells, at the end of which the cells were mature and they were shoved out into the blood. Clearly, this small degree of amplification could not account for the enormous numbers of cells that we know must be produced over our lifetimes. So the question was, what was the nature of the cells that were responsible for this extra enormous cell-producing capacity? And what Drs. Till and McCullough were able to show for the first time was that there exists in the bone marrow another class of very primitive cells that have not yet made up their minds whether they're going to be white cells or red cells. Not only that those cells have the capacity to make demonstrably millions of daughter cells. So let me now show you an old slide taken from their work, which describes the experiments they undertook 30 years ago that set the field on fire. What we see here is the idea of taking cells out of the bone marrow of a donor mouse, making a single cell suspension. Each of these is a cell of these bone marrow cells. And then they were injected into immunologically compatible mice that have been given a big dose of irradiation so that their own blood-forming systems have been obliterated, and the animals turned on growth factors that said, make new blood cells. And they stimulated the injected blood cells that homed into the spleen to divide and differentiate. And by injecting small numbers of cells, what Drs. Till and McCullough discovered was that one could find in the spleen of these animals, a week and a half later, little bumps made up each of about 1 million or 10 million cells. And what they went on to show was that those little bumps were actually colonies, that is, all of the cells could be shown to have arisen from one single cell. Here's another colony over here, also derived from a single cell, but a different single cell. And within the colonies were both red cells and white cells. Therefore, the cell that gave rise to that colony had the capacity to generate both red cells and white cells. Even more fascinating, one could take out these colonies with the cells alive and run them through this same exercise so that instead of taking now cells from the marrow, the bone marrow of the original mouse, one took cells from these little bumps, made a single cell suspension, injected them into another group of irradiated mice, and one got new bumps on the spleens of these secondary mice that were identical in composition to the first. So there were in these colonies not only cells that could develop into mature blood, red blood cells and mature white blood cells, the cell of origin could make new uncommitted cells of its own type. So this introduced the concept of a stem cell that was not yet decided in what lineage of blood cell it was going to generate progeny, and that it had extensive capacity to make more cells of itself. Sorry, I can't hear you. An irradiated mouse? That is a mouse that has been given a large dose of X-rays or other types of radiation, such as what we use to treat tumors in the clinic. So this is ionizing radiation, like high-energy X-rays. And radiation blocks cell division. And since blood formation, as I've just described, involves a tremendous amount of cell division, this is a standard way of experimentally wiping out the bone marrow and blood-forming system of experimental animals. And one can use those as recipients to study incoming stem cell activity. So these seminal observations from the Toronto group gave birth to the now widely accepted concept that blood formation is very complex. In fact, I've been rather simple in my descriptions to you. There are not just red cells and white cells. There are actually a very large number of different lineages of blood cells. And we now know that they all come from one single common stem cell, and that that cell has the capacity to renew itself, as well as giving rise to all of these different lineages. That the process spans many cell divisions, not just a few, not even just enough to make a million cells. And so there has been much interest over the last three decades in developing methods for quantitating this cell and studying its properties and understanding its regulation and understanding what kinds of mutations occur in it and how they make this cell become leukemic, because this is the cell that is mutated in many forms of leukemia. Now, of course, we could not use mice to study human cells, or at least we couldn't in those days. And so there was tremendous interest in looking at some kind of alternative approach that would be applicable to human cells. And the obvious alternative approach was to try and develop tissue culture strategies for studying early types of human blood-forming cells. And the general principle that developed starting in the 60s and moving through the 70s was to take isolated single-cell suspensions from the bone marrow of mice and people and put them into a tissue culture which contained a matrix so the cells would be held apart, not allowed to intermingle, and then provided with specific molecules that would stimulate the primitive cells to grow. And so if one got the ingredients right and the cell numbers right, one would have the mature cells die off over time in the incubator, and the primitive cells would grow, and because they were locked into this matrix, all of their daughter cells would be restrained in the immediate environment, and one would get a colony, much like I described to you occurred in the spleen. And in fact, over the years, we have learned in the field how to do this to generate all types of different colonies representing all of the different blood cell lineages and different stages of blood progenitor development along those lineages. And in the next slide, I'll show you a picture that was taken in our laboratory of a tissue culture where we have side by side growing a colony of white blood cells, roughly 3,000 or so white blood cells in this colony, and over here a colony of red blood cells. This is completely homogeneous in that all of the cells in this colony are white blood cells. This is also homogeneous. You can't appreciate it very well, but these cells are actually red because they're full of hemoglobin and represent now mature red blood cells derived from a single cell plated probably about there in the tissue culture at time zero. So this is a picture taken in a tissue culture that was 2 to 3 weeks old, and the original cell that sat there and there grew many divisions, but this cell had already probably decided that it could only be, it could only generate red blood cells, and this one only white blood cells. So we learned a lot about the hierarchical makeup of blood cell formation through the advent of this kind of assay. Equally important, we learned a great deal about the molecules required to stimulate the growth of these cells. In fact, it was these kinds of procedures that allowed people in the field to purify those molecules and eventually clone the genes that encode those molecules and allowed them to be expressed in bacteria and yeast. And now many of them are pharmaceutical reagents that are used to facilitate blood cell recovery in the clinic. So these were very important observations that helped us understand blood cell formation, but also the factors, the molecules that are produced by other cells that control these events. However, studies in the mouse clearly told us that we could not get the most primitive cell in the system to proliferate in this kind of a system. And so one was forced to look at alternative types of tissue culture systems. And here is such a system. This is one that was developed by a group in Manchester in Great Britain, and it is the exact opposite of the last type of tissue culture system. In the last condition, cells are plated in very dilute form so that one can recognize the individual clones, and they're suspended in a matrix so that the cells are kept apart. In this system, the cells, at least as it was first described, the cells from the bone marrow are put into a liquid culture system and at very high cell density. And what was observed to happen under those conditions was that if everything was right, the cells would settle down on the bottom of the tissue culture vessel and basically establish an entire bone marrow situation. One had not only the blood-forming cells growing in this tissue culture, one had the environmental cells, the support cells that constitute the bone marrow fabric and serve as a spongy network in which blood-forming cells nestle and are regulated. Those cells, too, would proliferate and generate a proper environment in these tissue culture dishes. And here in the next slide is a picture again from our own laboratory of what this actually looks at like. And you can't see it very well, but there are sort of long stringy gray things in the background. That is the stromal background of the marrow microenvironment reestablished in this tissue culture on the bottom of the dish. And these round black or dark gray dots, these are the blood-forming cells that are responding to signals from the long stringy cells and growing and proliferating and generating blood cells over very long periods of time. And so these cultures were called long-term cultures. And we learned that one had to have both elements. Now, what made this culture system very attractive was that the group in Manchester showed that when this system was set up with murine cells, those cells that could make spleen colonies in mice could be produced in these cultures for many, many weeks. And it seemed to us that if that was true, and nothing was going bizarre in these cultures, then there must be cells in the original inoculum that went into the culture that were very primitive, maybe the most primitive cells. And they were responsible for ultimately generating all of the derivative cells. And if we waited long enough, we could use a measure of the derivative cells to tell us how many of those very early cells we had in the beginning inoculum. And so we used the system to develop a test procedure, if you will, for measuring very early cells by providing the background, by establishing it beforehand, and then adding in very small numbers of cells and measuring their progeny using the colony assay, either the spleen colony assay in the murine system or subsequently in the human system, the tissue culture colony forming assay that I've just described to you, which we could also do in the mouse system. And those sorts of studies worked very well, and we learned that we could quantitate very early cells, and we learned from the murine studies that this test procedure looked like it was measuring the cell that we were interested in, that very, very early cell that's responsible for maintaining the whole blood-forming system, or at least an overlapping cell. And so we've done many, many things with that cell, but perhaps the simplest to describe and the most spectacular have been experiments designed to make that cell grow in tissue culture. And of course, the most obvious place to try to begin to do that was in this kind of system itself. Since we knew this system was triggering those cells to divide and give off mature progeny, it wasn't too unreasonable to think that it might be replicating itself, just as I described to you happened in the spleen colonies for a slightly more differentiated cell. And so, of course, we did many experiments to investigate that possibility. The cell, the name of that we gave to the cell that is in the original inoculum that is measured in this long-term culture was a long-term culture initiating cell, which we've abbreviated in many papers as LTCIC, and you'll see that coming up many places, whereas CFU stands for colony forming unit, the tissue culture colony forming cell. You don't have to understand this slide. This shows numbers on this axis, on the vertical axis, and time on the horizontal axis. The only thing you have to appreciate is everything's going down. So we start with something and we have less later. And it didn't matter what we did with these cultures, try as we may, things always went down. They didn't go precipitously down, but we could never get a net increase. But we knew that this background of stromal cells was very important for even achieving this degree of maintenance. And so we thought maybe if we could get even more stromal cells squeezed into the culture, we would do even better. And so we tried a strategy where instead of just coating the bottom of the dish with stromal cells, we thought we would coat them on little balls, and then we would spin the balls around in a tissue culture, and that we could get more in, and we would get more value for money, if you will, from that kind of approach. I didn't have a lot of confidence in this strategy, but this is sort of what it looks like, where one has a device that stirs the medium around, and the cells are put into the medium, and in the initial experiments we had the stroma sitting on these little plastic spheres to create a sort of hyper-stimulation, if you will. Well, that original concept did not work, but what did work was when we put growth factors that by now we knew could act on primitive cells but couldn't act when we added them into the static cultures. Now, for the first time, instead of the LTCIC numbers going down, we had them going up. And so this, in our laboratory, started a whole new era of being able to investigate primitive cells and give hope to the concept that we could grow blood cells in culture, and that we would have now a mechanism for trying to understand what are the events that allow a primitive cell to make more of itself, as well as deciding how to differentiate. Just to bring you up to date to 1997, this is what we can do now. What I showed you in the last slide was about a 5 to 10-fold increase in these so-called LTCIC by using more purified cell suspensions and better growth factor cocktails. One can now get 50-fold, almost 100-fold increases in these cells from a normal human bone marrow. So we're very excited about these developments. Of course, I've made the story very simple. I've picked only on one aspect of regulation of primitive cells. That is the control of self-renewal, producing daughter cells that are identical to the original cell, as opposed to differentiating. One of the things that we've learned very recently is that we can use growth factors not only to support these processes, but to actually dictate how much the arrows will go in this direction and how much the arrows will go in this direction. That's very exciting in terms of our being able to control the process. It's also very exciting in terms of giving us new tools to investigate the process. But there are other processes that are important. Primitive cells can die, and we now know that that too is under the control of growth factors. Primitive cells can also go into a dormant state as opposed to being in a state where they're trying to divide. And again, growth factors control that process. So we have a complex series of options, some of which are mutually exclusive, some of which are not, all of which can be regulated by growth factors, some the same, some different, different responses with different growth factors. Even more exciting is the fact that we know from a large number of different inputs that different genes within the cells are affected and control each of these different processes. These genes are highly conserved throughout organisms. The same genes govern the same processes in very primitive organisms as control them in these blood cells. And not surprising, because these very processes govern cell numbers, mutations to these genes or alterations to these genes are involved in many malignant transformation events, are associated with leukemia, are even associated in other tissues with other kinds of cancer. So let me now leave normal cells and try to tell you a little bit about how we've tried to use this knowledge to understand leukemia and develop new treatment strategies. So here's leukemia. You remember, at the very beginning, I tried to teach you that there are roughly 200 times as many red cells as white cells. And I think you can appreciate, if I tell you these are the red cells at the bottom, and these are the white cells in the middle, and this is fluid on the top, that the ratios got out of kilter. So this is clearly a leukemia where we have way too many white cells being produced. In fact, this is not just any old leukemia. This is a particular type of leukemia, which we call chronic myeloid leukemia, and is one that we chose to study in particular because all cases of chronic myeloid leukemia are caused initially by the same mutational event, and we can see that by looking at the chromosomes of individual cells in patients with that kind of leukemia, and we can track every single leukemic cell because it possesses that chromosomal change. So we have a nice marker for telling when we have a leukemic cell and when we don't. In this particular leukemia, we know that the initial cell transformed is a pluripotent stem cell, that is the cell right up at the top that I showed you that can give rise to all of the lineages. So we would be very interested to know how that cell goes wrong. And we know in the initial stage of the disease that the process of maturing into blood cells is really very little affected. So the red cells in this particular patient are actually derived from the same leukemic stem cell as the white cells. They mature normally, but they are still members of the leukemic clone. We know from studies of the atomic bomb survivors that the cell that is initially affected and acquires this mutation takes roughly 6 or 7 years to grow into a large clone of cells, more than a trillion cells, so that we can detect it in the body, and even 10 times that number, so that the patient who has the disease develops symptoms and goes to his physician or her physician. Because the cells differentiate, it's really not a problem to the patient initially, except there are too many cells. But inevitably, on average, about 5 years later, some of the cells will acquire additional chromosomal abnormalities, additional mutations, and now the cells become very abnormal, and the patients develop an acute type of leukemia, which is untreatable and fatal. So the challenge is to try and develop treatment strategies that will eliminate this bad clone before it gets to this untreatable state. And at the present time, except for a few patients who will respond to interferon, bone marrow transplantation using a related donor is the only curable treatment that will cure a significant proportion of these patients. But unfortunately, most patients are older and are either ineligible for that form of treatment or do not have a suitable donor. So this is still a very big problem for many people who develop this disease. Now, because this was clearly a stem cell disorder, way back in the early 80s, when we were first involved in trying to apply our experimental techniques to the study of this disease, an obvious approach was to try and put this disease into the long-term culture system, which we believed was supporting the growth of very early cells. In fact, I described to you how we could monitor that. And we rapidly discovered that, contrary to our expectations, the LTCIC, the leukemic stem cells, disappeared very rapidly under these culture conditions. They survived much more poorly than normal LTCIC. Big disappointment. Failure. The challenge to the investigator, however, is to turn failure into opportunity. Two sides to every coin. So what was the opportunity? I described to you the concept of bone marrow transplantation. Imagine if we could take the patient's own bone marrow and recover from that the normal stem cells, wouldn't that be an ideal opportunity to allow many more patients to be treated with big league therapy requiring rescue of the marrow, but now using the patient's own normal cells, their own residual normal cells, to allow for that recovery to occur? Of course, that wouldn't work unless one could get rid of the leukemia that was in the bone marrow. And up until that time, we really had no way of thinking about doing that. This culture strategy suggested to us a way of purging the patient's own marrow of those leukemic cells. So the idea was we would identify suitable patients, we would take enough bone marrow out of them that we would have sufficient normal cells to serve as a transplant. We would culture them for a brief period of time, long enough based on those curves I just showed you, to reduce the leukemic stem cell burden to an ineffectual level. While that was occurring, while that culture was occurring, we would treat the patient as if they were going to have a sibling transplant. But instead of using a sibling transplant not available, we would then reinfuse the purged cells back into the patient. We geared ourselves up to do this. And in 1987, we treated the first patient. This is what one patient's transplant looks like in the incubator in the Terry Fox Laboratory. You can imagine this takes a team of very skilled people, both in the laboratory and in the clinic. And this is indeed a pioneering team effort. We've treated quite a few patients on this first trial. As you can see, we're now out well past 9 years since we treated that patient. This is a survival curve. So we start here with all of the patients, and we end up here with about half of the patients. Almost all of the patients in the early phase after being infused with these cultured transplants recovered with normal cells. So we're very excited about the culture purging. Unfortunately, the treatment that is given to the patients is almost certainly not enough to eradicate all of the leukemic cells that were in their bodies. So eventually, over time, these regrow. And only in two cases are we confident that we probably have eliminated all of the leukemic cells. Nevertheless, these patients are living longer than we would have expected. So we believe this is not the be-all and end-all to the treatment of this disease, but this offers a very important new strategy that may be folded into a multifaceted approach to try to improve therapy of this disease. Equally important, we now have confidence that we can maintain an individual's bone marrow cells outside of their body for extended periods of time, in this case 10 days, and then we can put it back into them with no, as far as we know, adverse effects. So this really sets the stage for gene therapy. Exciting days. Now, what can I fold my talk with in terms of telling you some of the tidbits of where we are now in terms of excitement? Early on, I said we didn't think we could use any kind of transplantation into experimental animals approach to measure human stem cells of the blood-forming system because the immunological barriers were too great. What has happened over the last two decades is that experimental mice have been developed that have genetically determined deficiencies in their immune system, sufficient so that it is now, in fact, possible by choosing the right combination of mutations in mice to get human blood-forming cells to grow in the bone marrow of those mice after they have been treated with irradiation. So we can now begin to use mice to develop, in fact, transplantation assays for human bone marrow stem cells. And we can take our work beyond the LTCIC measurement into a real in vivo situation. Not only that, we can use this approach to establish human disease and strategies for treating human disease in mice so that we may not have to go through the laborious procedure of evaluating different therapies in patients. Equally exciting is the fact that we can use this approach to learn best how to transfer genes into these very early cells that can reconstitute the entire blood-forming system. So we have just recently completed experiments to show that we can, in fact, take single human stem cells and reconstitute both the white blood cells and the red blood cells series of mice from single cell, individual human stem cells. And because we have that capacity, we can work out and have worked out methods for putting new genes into those cells. We've known for quite a long time how to put genes into intermediate types of human blood-forming cells, but we've had very disappointing results in the field at large in getting new genes into those very primitive cells, which is where we have to put them if we're going to have any permanent effect in a transplantation scenario. So these are very exciting data which show this bacterial gene in white blood cells and red blood cells reconstituted in mice from human cells that were treated with this gene before the transplant occurred. So that brings me full circle. These are very exciting times in biomedical science. And I would like to leave you with where I feel we are at this moment. Thank you very much.
Well, we'll have the usual question period now. Who wants to start?
Yes.
Peter?
Dr. Eaves, you mentioned one of the problems with the autografting was that you weren't able to completely purge the system of leukemic cells. Where are the those residual cells that you can't purge? Are they still in the blood?
Because the cells that are in the graft are identical to the cells in the patient, we cannot at this moment say for sure where the recurrence is coming from. But because the recurrence occurred many months after the transplant, long after blood cell recovery took place with normal cells, we are encouraged to think that the purging was highly effective, but there were still residual leukemic cells in the patient, that the treatment that was given to the patient was not sufficient to eradicate. And in fact, since that trial was initiated, it's now become appreciated that in a transplant situation where one uses a transplant from a related donor, a lot of the benefit actually comes from the fact that there is nevertheless some immunological difference between that donor and the recipient, and those cells are actually immunologically attacking the leukemia. We don't have that possibility with the kind of auto transplant that we're describing, and So one approach that we are also trying to work on is to mimic that kind of an effect even when one's using an autologous transplant, a transplant from the patient themselves. Yes?
I'd like to ask you, in the broad field of research in which you're engaged, do you anticipate, say, in the next 10 or 20 years, that it will lead to a significant increase in average life expectancy for men and for women, say, from age 65 on?
Repeat the question.
My understanding of the question is, do I anticipate that in the next 10 or 20 years, the kind of research that I'm describing will lead to a significant prolongation of life beyond 65 years?
Yes.
I think I'm optimistic. The rate at which science has progressed over the last 20 years is phenomenal, and we're on an exponential curve. So there's no question in my mind that medicine is going to improve. I guess if you ask me whether increased lifespan is going to be the correct measure of that, I would be a little bit more cautious. Remember that leukemia is, generally speaking, a very rare disease. It's not like breast or prostate, where our understanding is considerably further behind from a genetic point of view, from a mechanistic point of view, from understanding the biology of the cells. That doesn't mean we can't have more rapid advances, but we're not standing with that knowledge today. On the other hand, there are all sorts of other aspects that many of us now think are also important. It's not just the length of the life, but the quality of the life. And so I would hazard a guess that that will definitely be improved, even if the length of the life is not improved. I think actually 65 is an incorrect guess of what the average life expectancy. My understanding is it's well, like 75 or 80.
I wasn't making any such prediction.
Yeah.
Well, the verge of that breakthrough that you're getting, is it in leukemias or also in the amyloids and the myelomas and some of the other blood conditions?
Well, we would like to think that the mechanism might apply to other kinds of cells. There is some evidence that in other kinds of leukemia it may apply. It's not been possible to demonstrate that there is this kind of phenomenon going on in myeloma or lymphoma, but that's in part because we don't have the same ways of measuring the cells that are the bad guys in myeloma and lymphoma. Yes?
Dr. Eves, just for the general audience, could you clarify what fraction of this enormous biosynthesis of blood cells occurs in the bone marrow versus the spleen? Because you describe both as
yes.
The question.
The question is, what is the relative importance of the bone marrow to the spleen in the production of blood cells? I should have clarified that. In people, normally, the bone marrow throughout adult life is almost the exclusive site of production of blood cells. Mice are a little different. There is significant blood cell formation occurs in mice, but that is not characteristic of people. Normally.
Is there a rule for mammals?
Well,
you've just given us two species. Well, you know, what's the general distribution of this amongst animals?
I think it's a difficult question. I'm not expert enough in enough other mammals, but I believe that the use of the spleen for blood cell formation is more characteristic of rodents. And I would imagine, but I don't actually know what the rules are for mammals in general.
Back there?
Does that mean that after finding the blood of somebody who's sick, you transfer the blood back into the bone marrow?
Most of the
question.
Sorry, the question is, do we take the blood and incubate it in tissue culture and then put it back in the patient and have it go to the marrow? So far, all of the work I described to you was actually done not with blood, but with bone marrow. So the bone marrow is sucked out of the marrow of the patient under anesthesia and then put into tissue culture and then injected back into the bloodstream, and the cells find their way back into the bone marrow. We are also doing similar experiments, clinical trial, if you will, with primitive cells that are out in the blood. And our measurements would suggest that the same principles operate. But in normal blood, there are not very many stem cells. So that's not a good source of stem cells unless one manipulates the patient to call them out of the bone marrow into the blood.
We have a question over here.
My first question is...
One question.
As you mentioned in the beginning, that about 300 billion red cells are being made each day and 100 billion white blood cells are being made. And is it that we need proper diet to maintain production?
The numbers of blood cells are huge. I use the number 300 billion cells being produced every day. And the question was, do we need to be concerned about our diet to make sure that we're able to produce blood cells properly?
And also the right ratio of red and white.
Yes. Okay, also the right ratio of red and white. Little addendum to the question here.
That's what he asked.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
And the platelets.
Yeah.
The general composition of cells in general is very similar. Red blood cells are unique in that they have this very high concentration of iron, which is the key component of hemoglobin. And I think it's be well known to many people in this audience, especially the women, if they don't eat enough iron-containing compounds, then they become anemic and they get tired, and that's because they're not making enough well hemoglobinized red blood cells. As far as I know, that doesn't impact at all on the decision of a primitive cell to become a red blood cell or a white blood cell, but it impacts on a cell that is already trying to become a red blood cell in being able to do that or not.
Here?
Yes.
As I've got older, I've noticed that I clock very much faster than I did when I was much younger. Is it because the surrounding skin is drier, or is this merely my imagination? In other words, the blood, any wound from a cut or an abrasion of some kind, seems to heal much faster now that I'm older.
Well, let me start. The question was, does the questioner's perception that his blood clots faster now that he's older have any physiologic basis that I could explain in terms of blood cell production? And the simple answer is no. A little bit more complicated answer is, I'm not a physician, and therefore, on two accounts, I will not answer your question. I recommend that you ask that of your physician. But I am not aware of any experimental evidence that suggests that age has anything to do with the kinds of blood cells that you produce that results in faster clotting of an older individual.
Yeah. Over here?
Yes. Is there a type of research going on elsewhere in the world?
Yes, fortunately. Is my kind of research going on elsewhere in the world? Sorry. And the answer is yes, fortunately, because one of the most important things, as all of you know, in research is that any observation that any individual makes is confirmed or refuted by somebody else. On the other hand, research in general, certainly this kind of laboratory research, is sufficiently complicated that it's rare that exactly the same experiment is being done in two centers at, or multiple centers at the same time without their knowledge of it and or in their interaction and discussion of it. So I think the extent to which there is overlap is healthy, and the extent to which there is not overlap promotes innovation.
Other questions?
There's one back here.
I was interested in what initiates the genetic mistake in the stem cell, which then causes the cancer. There was a discussion on CBC a few nights ago that there was in fact a slight increase in many cancers due to chemicals in the environment which might be getting worse. Do you feel that there are certain chemicals which induce these genetic mutations?
There are certainly chemicals that cause mutations. We've known that for a long time. One of the best known are products of smoking. As far as I know, they don't actually cause leukemia, but they certainly cause mutations in lung cells, which cause lung cancer. So we've known for a long time that chemicals cause cancer, cause mutations that lead to cancer. So the question is there an increase of chemicals in our environment that can account for an increased incidence of cancer, or even any specific type of cancer, and leukemia in particular? I don't think the answer is really in on that, but I don't think many of us are aware of strong indicators that that is the case, certainly not in the case of leukemia. And one of the strongest arguments that's given against that is that there are enormous numbers of natural compounds that have these effects. And we don't even know what the environmental load of those factors are. So I think, although many of us have empathy with the concept that we want to protect our environment and we want to protect our race from mutagenic insult due to abusing our environment, we have to be very careful not to globally extrapolate from that. There are clearly situations where chemicals in our environment are bad for our health and cause cancer. I don't think leukemia is a good example of one of those.
Is this type of research shared between university facilities and private facilities, as was indicated by one of our previous speakers? And if so, do you share with private investigations?
The question is the research that I've described shared between university facilities and other facilities and private sources of resources?
Well, private, like drug
industrial sources.
Yeah.
And the answer to your question would be yes, all of those contribute to sustaining the laboratory activity, but the amount of resource that comes in from private sources would be rather small relative to the resources that are obtained through the National Cancer Institute, the Medical Research Council, the BC Health Research Foundation, and through the infrastructural support of the people, the faculty, and the buildings in which the work is done, which comes through the hospital and the university.
In other words, it's not much proprietary work going on in,
no,
say, large pharmaceutical firms,
no,
which you are not aware of, which is not open to you?
No.
Okay. Other questions? Yes.
There's an article in the paper this morning talking about synthetic blood products, mentioned specifically an oxygen carrier.
Yes.
Would this be a cultured thing like we're talking about, or is it a major stretch?
The question is, there was an article in the newspaper this morning, which I have to say I did not see, describing artificial blood. And the question is this a offshoot of the kind of research I've described, which involves growing blood cells in culture, or is this some other type of artificial blood? Since I didn't read the article, it's a little difficult for me to answer that. But I know that there are laboratories and industries that are working on completely artificial sources of blood function. That is, in particular, molecules that can be infused into the blood that will carry oxygen, which is the major function of the red blood cell. And so that would have nothing to do with a tissue culture generation of cells, which is the kind of work I described. So I suspect that that's what you read about, but I don't know.
Other questions? Over here?
I'm wondering if the problem of chemo is related to increased blood reaction, whatever in the air, from the thousands of antibodies that have been exploded. So,
the question is, sorry.
And also, I'm wondering about the nourishment on a more fundamental level. Where did the stem cells get the nourishment from to grow? Where did they receive instructions from to do what they do? It can't probably be on a biochemical level. It must be subatomic. I don't know how to explain it. It's something to explain that. Where's the decision-making mechanism in this stem cell? Where does it get its nourishment from? How does it turn out? The way I see it, it must be at a subatomic level, somewhere between the mind and the body. You see the posture that I'm coming at?
Well, I'm going to have trouble repeating the question.
Yeah.
But I will try to at least repeat the first question, which I believe was, is there an increased incidence in leukemia that can be attributed to increased radiation? And I don't believe there is any strong evidence for there being an increased incidence of leukemia, and so I don't think it would be appropriate to extrapolate what are the changing causes of leukemia, since we don't have any handles on that. The second question had to do with how do the blood stem cells get their nourishment. And I think it's important to make a distinction between nourishment and growth factors that actually cause changes in the behavior of stem cells, which is what I tried to give you a flavor of in this talk. I didn't talk at all about run-of-the-mill nourishment. In fact, one of the answers to an earlier question was that most cells are pretty similar in the kinds of general makeup and nourishment that they require, and that comes through the blood forming through the blood and diffuses into the tissues, and then the cells take up those building blocks that allow them to construct the makeup of cells. But those are, in general features of cells, and they don't differ radically from one cell type to another. What's key to understanding blood cell formation as opposed to skin cell formation is understanding the genes that are active in those different types of cells that cause them to be different, and the molecules that trigger them to change their behavior to mature or divide or generate more stem cells of the tissue. So that's the best I can do.
Any other questions? Well, Connie, before I ask Dr. Yorsch to thank our speaker tonight, I have two comments to make. First of all, we have in the next week two lectures, one on Wednesday and one on Saturday. The Wednesday lecture, that doesn't happen very often. The last time we did that was with Mr. Reynolds, the former Prime Minister of Ireland. We have this time Ms. Slavenka Draculic, who's a very well-known writer and journalist. At least she's very well-known in Europe and in New York. And she's coming here. She's Croatian and coming here to talk about Words and Bullets, A Writer and the War. We believe that will be a very popular lecture, so I urge you to come early on Wednesday. Then on Saturday next week, we have Professor Richard Poley of the Faculty of Commerce and Business Administration at UBC, and he's talking about A Pack of Lies, the truth about cigarette advertising. We've arranged, especially the Institute arranged this year, that this would be a topic debated this week in the Parliament in Ottawa. And it's quite interesting from the top. And it's a very topical thing, and we urge you to come to that as well. The second comment that I want to make is that we invite you, after this lecture and after the thanks, to have coffee and cookies outside and to ask more questions of Dr. Eaves. We also, again, warmly invite you to join the Institute for as many times as you like. And remember, the Institute is free. We will think no differently of you if you don't join. But it will make you feel very happy if you actually go up to the desk and to take out a one or two or three family memberships. I will now go and ask Dr. Ralph Yorsch to thank our speaker for tonight.
Dr. Eaves, it's my distinct pleasure to be allowed the role of thanking you as a speaker. If your research skills are as good as your communication skills, this audience will have a great deal to be optimistic about, and we thank you very much for having given us that note of optimism. Thank you again.